AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.
Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mount of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called out to him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. All right, so a couple of things going on here. First of all, Jethro is a great name for somebody in the Middle East. We think of, who is that? He's Beverly Hillbillies. Was that the dad in Beverly Hillbillies?
No. Yeah.
The son, yeah, Jethro and Billy Bob, and yeah, so yeah, Moses, son-in-law of Billy Bob. So Moses goes out in the wilderness. Moses marries a woman outside in the wilderness, and he's gonna basically live his own life apart from the Israelites, apart from the Egyptians. He left all that nonsense behind him. He's living on his own as a shepherd now. One time, as he was keeping the flock, it says he's on Mount Horeb. And an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. This is one of those times when you have the phrase an angel of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord is referring to God himself. So this is why we'll often argue that the angel of the Lord, like Michael, is actually God himself. So in this case, God is speaking out of a burning bush. It's regarded as the angel of the Lord. And then it says that the Lord himself spoke out of the bush. Moses is going to get near to the bush, but he can't. He's supposed to take off his sandals because what he's standing on is holy ground. This idea that we have, we do come up with a lot of superstitions about, you know, what to do around holy things, you know, how to behave in church, how to dress in church, how to approach the altar. For me, how to behave when I'm up at the altar, things like that. And for a lot of people, when they come in, they can see these things and say, why make this whole big superstitious, you know, mess out of things? Just come to church and, you know, in a sleeveless shirt and basketball shorts and Cheeto stains all over, and why make a big deal about it, right? You know, the Bible never says that you have to dress nice for church, or you have to behave a certain way, or be quiet in the pews, or be reverent when you're being a pastor. But you do have a pattern that happens in the Bible, and you'll see this here, but you'll see this later on when God specifically prescribes behaviors of priests and things that you're allowed to do and not to do in the temple, things like that. But you have this idea that this is a God thing, that regarding something as sacred, as special, treating it gently, treating something as holy ground, behaving a little bit differently, dressing a little bit differently when you're interacting with holy things. Now, this is not going to be literally, you know, God speaking out of a burning bush. This is not going to be the Ark of the Covenant that if you touch it and you're not supposed to, you die. But to a degree, we still do carry on this tradition that God came up with of treating area where holy things is going on, where holy things are going on, as special, as sacred ground. In the United States, I believe that there's actually laws. I think they're called the sanctuary laws, if you've heard of them. If somebody comes into a church, they can actually declare sanctuary, and they've got basically 3 weeks that they can stay in the church before they have to be legally removed. Yeah, it's weird. It's rare that it ever happens, and people aren't familiar with it. But there, at least in Europe, This was one of the things that happened, claiming sanctuary within a church. There's a couple of good fiction stories. I think The Hunchback of Notre Dame includes that law as well.
Sanctuary!
As well as in the Bible, I forget who it is, comes up and grabs onto one of the horns of the altar, and it's called one of the mercy horns or something like that. So as long as you're touching the mercy horn of the altar, you can't be touched by the law, that sort of thing. So there is this concept of in the church, in the temple, in a cathedral, and whatever, that it should be regarded with a degree of dignity, with a degree of special care, that you wouldn't treat it as though it's any other building, it's any other thing going on. Something special is happening here. This is one of the reasons why we don't have, concerts and as beautiful as jazz music is, as beautiful as jazz music is and bands and stuff like that, we don't have a rock and jazz band up here at the altar, with a projector screen blocking the cross. These things can be good, but this is reserved for a special place. This is reserved for special stuff that's going on here. And we want to regard that in how we decorate the church and how we have, beautiful colors and flowers and how we behave in church, how we dress in church, things like that. All right, let's see. So in this case, take off your sandals, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. So because God is present there, that's what makes the ground holy. It's not a magical place in itself, although mountains were traditionally regarded as the place where you go to talk with God. Elijah goes up on a mountain, talks with God. Moses talks with God later on. This is Jesus when he goes up on the mountain for the transfiguration, for the mountain for the ascension. He goes up on the mountain for the crucifixion. These are all things that happen, special things happen with God on mountains.
How many years was Moses in Midian?
Let me see if it says this here.
It seems like I remember a number, but he was, I think, what, in the 70s when he went back here?
I think it says... It says later on, I think it says his age when he goes back. And I think we deduce from his age when he goes back how long he's been there. It doesn't say right here, but he's no longer, by the time he goes back to Egypt, he's no longer a young man. The Charlton Heston depiction, I would say, is accurate in this case.
I don't know what the age was when he left.
Right. Well, when he left Egypt, it says Moses had grown up. It says when he had grown up. Not sure what that means. I wouldn't say he would be later in life. So again, if you're thinking Charlton Heston, probably not gray hair yet. So I would say at least the Ten Commandments movie is accurate so far in that. I don't think he was, maybe he was 18.
And then
could have been.
Was Jethro, were they Hebrew? Were they?
So it's the note that I have here, it says, just as Melchizedek, so remember Melchizedek comes out of nowhere and blesses Abraham. He's a priest of Salem. He was a mysterious figure. So was this priest of Midian. The gods he worshipped are never described. So could he possibly be a Yahwist? Maybe. Could he possibly be a pagan? Maybe. It doesn't actually say. It just says that he's a priest and he's in Midian. And so what do you do with that? What do you make of that? So, God leads Moses out. Moses gets married here to his Jethro's daughter. Okay. Yes, sir.
Did you say Jethro? He's a Midianite.
Jethro is a Midianite, yeah. So he's from the land of Midian. It says he's a priest. It says he's a Midian priest at the beginning of the chapter. And then on chapter 2, verse 16 as well, you'll also see that it's mentioned that he's a priest of Midian, and he had 7 daughters. So what does that mean specifically? Is he like Melchizedek, where he's a faithful Yahwist and he just happens to live in Midian? Or is he a priest of another religion? And that's a little bit complicated. All right, verse 7. So he's speaking to God in the burning bush. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering, and I have come out, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to the Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. All right, so he's going to come back to this mountain later on. The funny thing is Moses, out of anybody, Moses would have been the one qualified. He alone, I mean, he grew up in the Pharaoh's court. He would have understood the Egyptian culture well. He wouldn't have had any problem with Egyptian language versus the Hebrew language. Yes, he was raised by the Hebrews, by his mother, but he was also raised in the Egyptian court. So really, God specifically prepared him by raising him in the court of Pharaoh, prepared him for this task. Likewise, he wasn't just a nobody. He could walk right up to Pharaoh. I mean, he may not survive, but Pharaoh would recognize him. He wasn't just a random Israelite slave. So Moses says, who am I that I should do this? And I mean, the answer is, well, God specifically made you and prepared you for this task in this case. Similarly, I just did a Bible study the other day on David and Goliath. Who is David to kill Goliath? Well, God prepares David to kill Goliath. David killed bears and lions and tigers, oh my. And then God brings him Goliath the giant to kill. So in these cases, God does actually prepare people with specific skills and abilities that he uses later on. So Moses being a shepherd for a while, that'll come in later when he has to shepherd people around. But him being a shepherd is not what prepared him so much to talk to Pharaoh, but him maybe being raised in the court of Pharaoh was. All right, let's see. Another thing. So God has heard the cry of the people of Israel. Now, the people of Israel have been oppressed for a while. This is going to spoil the sermon a little bit today, but you're going to hear a story about a parable about a woman nagging a judge again and again and again and again. And God said, and the judge eventually gives her what she wants. And God says, look, if this unrighteous judge is willing to listen to this woman, this is how you should keep praying too. You should, in fact, continue to pray for the same things over and over and over. You're not going to annoy God, but he's listening. He hears her cries. So even though it takes a while from our perspective for God to save the Israelites from Egypt, God does hear the cries of the Israelites that continue to ring out. They didn't give up and say, well, God isn't coming. Guess we'll just, you know, pretend there is no God. Verse 13, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say? God said to Moses, I am who I am, otherwise known as Yahweh. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent you. God said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what is done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice. You and the elders of Israel shall go to the kings of Egypt and say, the king of Egypt, and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand, and I'll strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go, and I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. When you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor, and any woman who lives in her house, for silver and gold jewelry, for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians. So remember that God is the one who made the Egyptians rich in the first place. They had, however big of a country they had, when he brings Joseph into the land of Egypt, he makes them immensely wealthy, not just with their land, but with all the treasures that the people are giving to pay for food during the famine. So God is the one responsible for the wealth of the Egyptians in the first place. Ultimately, this wealth is going to be used to bless the Israelites, bless the people who leave. Now, you'll remember possibly in the story later on when the Israelites leave the Egyptians, they don't leave with just the clothes on their back. They leave with all kinds of treasure with them. This is why they can go and build not just the Ark of the Covenant, but the tabernacle, all these golden plates and bowls and lampstands and stuff, how they can use this gold to build the golden calf. So they've got lots of treasure that they bring with them out of Egypt. So it's not that they're just going to get out by the hair, by the skin of their teeth, but that they're going to plunder the Egyptians as they get out. All right, so the name of God is really important. You will see in your Bible, if you look at the Bible, there will probably be, it'll say the Lord, but Lord will be capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. This is a replacement. The word that is used every time you see L-O-R-D in all capitals, sometimes it's not capital, L-O-R-D in all capitals, is Yahweh. The reason the word is replaced in the Bible goes back to an ancient tradition, which if I started reading from the pulpit and every time it says the Lord, I just said Yahweh, if I was 100% confident everybody would know what I'm talking about, I would do that. Because that's what it says in the Bible. It says Yahweh. It doesn't say the Lord. The Lord is a different word. The reason people replaced the word Yahweh with the word the Lord is because God's name is holy. Now, you remember we talked about, you know, you're approaching the burning bush. Don't stand here with your sandals on because this is holy ground. It's good to honor the things that are holy, but there are people who are scared of God's name. God's name is so holy, we don't want to use it. Therefore, we're going to replace God's name with a completely different word. That way, we don't accidentally take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. We use a different word instead. Yes, ma'am.
Is it Greek or Hebrew?
Yahweh is Hebrew. So Yahweh is Hebrew. In the Hebrew, we originally don't have vowels, which sounds strange, but somehow this is how they wrote their language. Originally, didn't have vowels. The Masoretes wrote vowels into the text, and this is how we get the word Yahweh, but it would be YHWH. It's four letters. It's called the Tetragrammaton, if you want to be fancy about it. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
So it was cultural.
Yes.
That name of Jesus was not to be said, not because he had...
Correct. Okay. So God never commanded not to use a name, but you'll remember in the Bible, God says, call upon my name. He regularly tells people to use his name. If you read Luther's Small Catechism, it says we should use his name, pray, praise, and give thanks. We should use God's name. We should not be afraid of using God's name. But the problem is that the people were so afraid that they might possibly misuse God's name that they stopped using it altogether, which is wrong. It is wicked. You are supposed to use God's name, and you're not supposed to be so terrified of God that you don't even touch his name, but rather you're supposed to say, I'll use God's name. I trust his mercy and grace to forgive me. Yes, ma'am.
So then, sorry.
Yeah, no.
So then Lord is more, like, instead of calling you Isaac, we call you Pastor. Like saying Lord instead of Yahweh.
Yes, except it's the other way. It's the other way around. Yeah, it would be kind of a generic name. So the term Lord does appear in the Bible. Not Elohim. Elohim is God. What is Lord? I'm blanking right now. So yeah, it would be like a title instead of a name. So when they refer to the Lord, and what was that?
Adonai,
that's it. Adonai. Adonai is the Greek word. You may have heard Adonai before. That means Lord. But that's also used for other people other than Yahweh. Yahweh is specifically setting himself apart. There is no other Yahweh. There never was another Yahweh. There are plenty of lords and ladies and all that, you know, seven lords of dancing. But there is only one, and there only has been one Yahweh. Now, this idea of Yahweh has, not using Yahweh's name, I brought this up before. This is not just an ancient Hebrew misunderstanding of the holiness of God's name, that it's so holy that you don't use it. It would be like saying, God is so holy, don't pray to him. Like, no, you're supposed to pray to God. You're not supposed to be afraid to use his name. You're not supposed to be afraid to pray to him, but you do respect him. You do honor his name. There is a word, and I will rail against this word every chance I get, and I am sorry if it hurts deep down, because you used this word before, but I don't like it, and I'll explain to you why I don't like it. Jehovah. The word Jehovah is nowhere in the Bible. I was actually printing out some notes for the 10 plagues of Egypt and how they correspond to the gods of Egypt. And two different sources. This one says the 10 plagues, Jehovah God versus the gods of Egypt. This one says the 10 plagues, Jehovah versus the gods of Egypt. Jehovah is not a word that's anywhere in the Bible. Jehovah isn't a real word. It's a made-up word. The way you get Jehovah is you take the letters, the four letters, Yahweh, Y-H-W-H, Yahweh, and then you interpose, You interpose the word for God, Elohim. That's the word, the Hebrew word for God, Elohim, like the gods of Egypt would be the Elohim of Egypt. You interpose the vowels from Elohim into the consonants of Yahweh. So the first vowel in Elohim is E. This is hard to do without a whiteboard. The first consonant in Yahweh is Y, so it would be Yah or Jah. There is no J in Hebrew. It would be Yah-ho, Elohim, Yahovah. So is it, well, let me just double check mentally. Is it Elohim, Yahoh, Elohim, Ado? No, it's not Elohim, it's Adonai. I'm sorry. It gets confused. I get Elohim. Elohim is God, Adonai is Lord. I get those mixed up. So it's the vowels from Adonai. So Yahovah, Adonai, A-I, Yahovah. All right, so the word Yehovah is an invented word from taking the consonants of one person, one name and then mashing them up with the vowels of another word together. It would be like if you wanted to make up a fantasy name for your character in a book that you're writing, and you say, well, I'm going to take the consonants from your name and the vowels from my name, and I'm going to mix them together every other one, and that's going to be the name of the character. That's what the word Yehovah comes from. That's less of a problem. That's creative, fun, sure, whatever. But the problem is that the word Jehovah, with the one word that doesn't exist, this word does not exist anywhere in the Bible. The one name that is never given to, ever used for God, is the one name that some groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses say you must use for God. They say you have to use this name for God. You cannot call God anything else except for Jehovah, this word that, by the way, we made up. And no, you're not allowed to use his real name. We're claiming that this is his real name instead. So it's a complete mix-up. You're supposed to use God's name and call upon it whenever you need it. Call upon it, pray, praise, and give thanks. But by using Jehovah, you're specifically avoiding using God's name. And if you're a Jehovah's Witness, you're saying you are not supposed to use God's name at all. You're supposed to use this made-up gibberish word instead. The problem is that the word Jehovah, the made-up gibberish word Jehovah, has been used so frequently in our society that many faithful Christians use it, not knowing it's not a real word. You'll see all this Jehovah Jireh, Jehovah this, Jehovah that, and a lot of times, it's usually, American evangelicals, Christians will talk about Jehovah as though this is just a word in the Bible that you can find in the Bible. It's just such a common word. I forget, there's a term for when somebody screws up how to pronounce a word, but that pronunciation becomes so common that everybody uses it now. It's basically that. So the word Jehovah is not a word that I use ever from the pulpit. It's not a word that I use when I'm praying. It's not a word that I use when I'm preaching, because it's not a word that's ever used to describe God in the Bible. Now, I'm okay with referring to God as the Lord in the Bible. The tradition behind it, I don't fully agree with, but I understand it. And we're so used to hearing the word the Lord instead of Yahweh that I'm okay with that. But specifically creating a word to avoid using God's name, I'm not okay with that. Because God is the Lord. God is not Jehovah. There is no Jehovah. Jehovah's not blah, blah, blah. That's Jehovah. It's gibberish. Yes, ma'am.
So there's no current word for Yahweh? Like, would it be appropriate for us to say Yahweh now?
You could say Yahweh now, absolutely. Yahweh is the name of God. In fact, specifically, God says here that it's his name forever. Now, what's important?
That's not like language. That's not what it would
mean. Right, right. So, like Jesus is the Greek. Well, Jesus is the English version of the Greek Yeshua. Yeshua is the Greek version of the Hebrew Joshua, or Greek would be Jesus. Hebrew would be Yeshua or Joshua. So, there is no translation of Yahweh. I mean, you could say I am. So when Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am, he's literally saying, that's who he's claiming to be. The Hebrew would be Yahweh. The Greek would be ego, a-me, spelled E-I-M-I, ego, a-me. Jesus, you've heard of the seven I am statements of Jesus. Have you heard of this before? I am the vine, I am the door, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Before Abraham was, I am. So Jesus does this on purpose. It's not that Jesus has bad grammar, but he specifically uses these statements, these I am statements, to say, hey, you remember Yahweh? That's me. That's specifically me. I'm not just a God, a Lord. I am, I am. That's what the word ego eimi is. Ego is I'm. Eimi is I am. So he's not saying I'm. He's saying I am, I am. I am, I am. So either Jesus is really bad with grammar or he's specifically claiming to be Yahweh of the Old Testament. So if you're wondering, the English word would be I am. It could be confusing. In Hebrew, a lot of times they use phrases as names. But yeah, so anyways.
So we should do our prayer through Yahweh.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, you can say, dear Yahweh. Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Yeah, you could say, you could pray to the Father, you pray to, you know. So yeah, you can do that. You could say, dear God, even though God, you could say, well, God is the title. You could say, dear Lord, Heavenly Father, you know, Mighty Counselor, Almighty God, any of these things. Dear Yahweh, Yahweh is his name, though. Yahweh is specific in that it is the name of God. So another variation on Yahweh. So Yahweh means I am. I am is present tense, first person present tense. I was would be past tense. I will be be future tense. So when he says I am and he takes this present tense and he applies it to all of history before Abraham was, past tense, I am, Jesus says, present tense. So Jesus is present. God is present tense in the past. God is present tense in the future. God is present tense in the present. It blows our mind because it doesn't make sense, but this is God talking about his eternality. It's not like there was a past God and God is different now, but rather I am the same yesterday, tomorrow, and today. There's another way to read this phrase, I am. Luther argues for it. You don't have to agree with him or not, but it is a potential way to read the conjugation or whatever of the Hebrew. The Hebrew I am is, you don't need to remember this. It is in the Q-O-L version of the word. So, you know, we would have past tense, present tense, future tense, passive, active. You know, passive would be I was hit by the ball. Active would be I hit the ball, that kind of thing. There's different variations on words. In this case, in the Hebrew, if you read it as the call, the Q-O-L, it's I am. If you read it as something called the hifil, you don't need to remember this, but there's hifil, hofil, a bunch of other variations of the word that you can figure out based on the vowels, which we don't have, and the context. If it was hifil, and Luther believes it was, it's not I am in the active voice, it's I am in the middle voice. It is I am he who causes. There's no English variant that's really spot on. But rather than I am here, it would be, I am he who causes the Israelites to come out of Egypt. I am he who causes the Egyptians to set free. I am he who causes existence to exist. I am he who causes creation to be created. And there's a bunch of theology that you can make, and Luther makes a bunch of theology based on this. But there's two different ways to read God's name. Either way works perfectly fine. Either I am as a statement of eternality, or I am he who causes, read I am, as a statement of the cause of all things. Either one of them is true. The more common reading is just reading it as I am. If that went over your head, don't worry. This is one of those things that they tell us in seminary to not bother with, because it leads to more confusion. It's fascinating, but it can lead to more confusion, especially since I'm not a linguist, so I couldn't answer all the questions about it. But it is something interesting to look into. Is Yahweh, is it Q-O-L or is it Hiphil, H-I-P-H-I-L? Which one is it? And then you can see the arguments of seminarians and professors online arguing about this. Either way, it works. All right, and then, so God is saying, this is, you know, I'm the God of your fathers. This is a regular phrase, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In case you forgot who he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So there's no confusion. God repeats this multiple times. I've talked about this before. Hebrew, the way of talking in Hebrew and telling history in Hebrew is helical. Things will come around, not like a spiral, not like they'll hit the same point, but they'll hit a similar point in a different way. He'll regularly use the same phrase to refer to the promised land, the land promised to your fathers. He'll use language to refer to himself in a similar way, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or the land of the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, whatever. You'll see this also. I love this in, I think it's in Daniel, where it talks about all the musical instruments that they're going to play before the fiery furnace, and it lists like the lyre and the bagpipes and the tambourine and the whatever. It lists like 16 instruments every time. This is just Hebrewism. We can appreciate it like that. All right. Chapter 4. Then Moses answered, but behold, so Moses is arguing with God. God is saying, hey, go set my people free. I will be with you. Don't worry. Who am I to tell them? You're the one that I chose. Now go. Who should I tell them has gone? Tell them that the God of their father has gone. This is my name, Yahweh. It was always my name. It will always be my name. Go. And now Moses answered, but behold, they will not believe her. So again, he's making excuses. Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And so again, this is, yeah, God knows what's in his hand. I've seen people argue, well, God says, where are you when he's walking in the Bible? He doesn't know where Adam and Eve are when he's walking in the garden. God says, what is that in your hand? As if he doesn't know that Abraham's or Moses is holding a stick. Okay, this is a linguistic construction we understand. Quick question, Moses, what is that in your hand? He said, a staff, and he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. So he put out his hand, and he caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that I am the Lord, the God of the fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, there you go again, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. And he put his hand inside the cloak. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, put your hand back inside your cloak. So he put his hand back inside his cloak. And when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe these two signs, or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. This is a foreshadowing of something that's going to happen later on. Now, God does a couple of interesting signs here. The first sign that he does, the way to prove that he is who he is he takes something inanimate and he turns it into a living thing. This is one of the first things that he does in all of creation, is when he takes Adam, he doesn't make Adam out of a monkey or another living thing, but he takes Adam and makes him out of the dust of the ground. He takes a serpent and makes it out of a stick. Maybe it was a tree at one point, but an inanimate object is turned into, he brings life to an inanimate object. He also...
Is that a foreshadowing of what's to come with the Pharaoh's magicians?
It is, yes. So that's exactly what he's going to use with Pharaoh's magicians, is it's going to be this contrast of look what God can do. Now, the magicians can do miracles. Now, it isn't just saying that they do a magic trick in the sense of an illusion, but there is actually the demonic ability to do miracles, to do signs and wonders, to do actual signs and wonders. It's limited, unlike God's power, though. And you'll see this in the contrast of what happens with Moses' snake and what happens with their snake. But so the first thing he does is he takes something inanimate and turns and creates life out of something inanimate. The second thing that he does is he takes a disease and he heals it. So there's leprosy, this incurable disease at this point, and he heals it. And it's a perfect kind of healing. And the third thing that he does is he takes water and he turns it into something that water never turns into. Water turns into blood in this case. And this is also a foreshadowing of what's going to happen later on. So he has this pattern of miracles that he's setting up for Moses to do. All right, Exodus chapter 4, where are we now? Verse 10. I love how this verse begins with, but Moses said. So but Moses said. So God says do this, but Moses said. God said do that, but Moses said. So he's got a laundry list of excuses. Yes, ma'am.
So it seems like he was trained, and he got both the Hebrew and the Egyptian.
Yes.
What he didn't have was the leadership skills yet. He didn't have that confidence.
Right, and how does God teach the leadership? By experience. And he's got, I mean, in terms of shepherding, like, oh, you dumb sheep, and hitting them with sticks and keeping them in line. But that's not the same thing as teaching them as he would have to do when he received the laws from God. So God has given him some preparation, but he's still going to have to, God is still working with him, still building him. Verse 10, but Moses said to the Lord, what's his excuse this time? Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent either in the past, since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Sometimes some translations say that I have a stutter. Then the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. But he said, oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak with him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth, and with his mouth, and I will teach you both what to do. And he shall speak to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be his God to him. And take in your hand this staff, which you shall do these signs. So Moses' excuse. Well, I can't talk so good. You know me, I don't talk so good. I'm just poor Moses. Who am I, God? And God's like, okay. That's enough. First of all, I'm the one who made mouths. I'm the one who knows how they work, and I can make your mouth work perfectly fine. If that's your complaint, I can handle it. Second of all, if you want to be such a baby about it, take Aaron, because I know you know he speaks really well. Take him with you. I'll tell you what to say. You tell him what to say. He'll tell the Pharaoh what to do. We good? Are you done with excuses yet, Moses? So it's interesting that this relationship builds up between God and Moses, and it's a special relationship. Moses ends up speaking to God face to face, and it refers to them as speaking kind of as friends. So they end up having so much back and forth communication. There's very few people in the Bible who get to do this. Abraham does it a bit, but Moses really does this, where he talks with God, and he complains to God, and he asks God for things, and God blesses him, and God gets angry with him, and God, it's a wonderful relationship that the two have, but it's interesting to see how Moses is kind of learning to stop making excuses and start trusting in God. So, all right. Did you have a question? Or
no.
All right. I will keep going. We are in Exodus chapter 4, verse 18. Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt. For all the men who are seeking your life are dead." Remember, Moses murdered the guy. So Moses took his wife and his sons and had them ride on a donkey, and he went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do before the Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he does not let the people go." This is going to be an important thing about who hardens Pharaoh's heart later on. "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son.'" God does not make empty threats here. If you remember the miracles, the plagues in Egypt, this is a very real threat. And it's not God just threatening people. You remember the sons of all of the Israelites were supposed to be killed by Pharaoh. Pharaoh was trying to kill the sons of all the Israelites, and God says, "You're going to let my firstborn son Israel go, the Israelites go, or else I'm going to kill your firstborn son." So this is absolutely absolutely deserved by Pharaoh. Verse 24: "At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and." The Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. And it was then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood," because of the circumcision. This is a weird sort of interjection. I want to see if there's any notes on this one in particular. Okay. So the note in the study Bible basically says that, and this is the reason that it's response to so the question is, who is being threatened with death? Why is God going to put Moses to death? Or is God going to put Moses' son to death? The text isn't really clear in what it says. There's not really any buildup to this. But Moses' response to then circumcise the son, this is the command given to the Israelites that they're supposed to circumcise their sons, that his response is this probably means that Moses knew that this was supposed to happen, that they were supposed to have already taken care of this thing, and he had been neglecting to follow in the religion of the Israelites that he was raised in. So because his response is to do this, my understanding of this text, which again kind of seems out of place, but we'll take it, that there was supposed to be a circumcision that happened. There wasn't a circumcision that happened. That God is angry to the point of, he's like, you better sort this out, or I'm gonna kill your son, or I'm gonna kill you, which seems extreme, but this is God. He's the one who gives life, he can take it away. And it's resolved with the circumcision. So, I mean, there's not really that much to say about this verse. It's probably another one of those verses that doesn't make it into the kids' study Bibles, or the kids' picture Bible book as much. But, I mean, every once in a while, you're going to come across verses like this that are just confusing. We'll have to ask God, hey, God, what was going on with this? And he'll say, oh, this is the situation. And he'll probably explain it in more detail. But based on the information that we have here, that would be my guess. Verse 27, the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord, which he had sent to him to speak, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, that he had seen their afflictions, they bowed their heads and worshipped. Good. So in the movies, maybe you see Moses goes back to Pharaoh first. No, in this case, Moses goes to the Israelites first with Aaron. Moses performs the miracles in front of the Israelites, and they believe. It's good. It's exactly what they're intended for. The problem is when he has to interact with Pharaoh. And we're going to get into that in later chapters in another day. But right now, Moses shows up to the Israelites. He says, God has heard your affliction. God is going to bring you out of Egypt. The Israelites believe. They're overjoyed. We're going to be saved. Thanks be to God. And we'll see how Pharaoh reacts to this news of the Israelites being excited. We will continue chapter 5 probably the next time, unless something fun or catastrophic comes up. In that case, let's close with the doxology.